Okay, we can continue that.
In this area right here, there was only one sawmill which run continuously and produced a steady payroll, and that was my dad's mill, Carnation Lumber Company. There were other mills on the river, such as Inman Polson, Eastern Wesson, and several other mills that I just don't recall their names at the present time, right at the moment here. They were running steady, but that even at, in the early 30s, even those mills were intermittent, because there just wasn't the orders to cut, and you couldn't go on cutting and supporting a payroll and having an old, a whole yard full of lumber inventory that wasn't moving. You couldn't have that kind of money tied up. There just wasn't that kind of money. But anyhow, Carnation Lumber Company, right here in this immediate locality, is the oldest continuous running sawmill and continuous payroll. And even though the mill has, since I sold out the sawmill, and two subsequent ownerships, the mill has never missed a day's payroll, a week's payroll, since I separated from the mill there. And when World War II come on, of course, I was in the last of my teens then, 19 and 20, I was just in my 20s, and of course, I went into the Air Corps in 1940 at the beginning after Pearl Harbor, went into the Air Corps, and ended up a navigator and gunner, heavy bombardment, 485th Bomb Group, 831st. Bomb Squadron, B-24 Consolidated, and went. We were assigned to replacement pool in England to the 8th Air Force, and we were there for a few days, but there was a shot up after North Africa, during North African campaign, and up through the Southern Italy campaign. Things were so desperate that they were so shot up that they needed crews down there badly, and they shipped, what was it, I think 14 or 16, 16 crews of us. They took us out of the 8th Air Force Replacement Depot, and we ended up in Casablanca, and then over through North Africa and into Southern Italy. And we started flying then, and we were in on the last of the Ploesti missions. Southern France D-Day. And then we flew missions in all over Germany. In Southern Germany and Czechoslovakia, Poland. Poland won mission. It was a long haul for us. Usually, those from Hamburg, Bremen, and all those northern targets. They were all 8th Air Force targets. And flew 56 missions, two and a half tours, and flew 56 missions, and. I was sure glad to get home, I'll tell you that. I used to think when during fighter attacks, when we had fighter attacks from the Germans, you didn't have time to think about home. You'd be surprised how, you know, when you sit here calm, your vision goes out at a certain angle. But when you're in combat, and you got somebody shooting at you, and those enemy planes buzzing all around you, suddenly your vision goes clear almost 360 degrees. But anyway, survived all of that, and come home here. And when I come home, fellas hadn't returned. I arrived home here before BJ Day. I arrived home here in May of 1945. And VJ Day never come until, I think it was August 15th or 20th, something like 15th, I think it was, at 1945. But anyhow, because of the scarcity of help, I took my old job, which I had held prior over in the mill. I took that until they could until some of the boys started coming home. And then I went across the tracks and purchasing agent of Carnation Lumber Company.
Who was running the mill during the war? Who wasn't operating much at
the
all?
The operation of the mill during the war, my father had incorporated, and he had two corporate partners, Clarence Adams and George W. Johnston. And George W. Johnston, who just died here a few months ago, a very fine man, very Christian man, he come to Dad in the early 30s, and he needed a job, and he needed it bad. And he was a bookkeeper. And Dad had decided that he didn't have the time to keep his own books any longer, so he hired him. And the man kept books for Dad all through the years, and then when Dad died, and shortly after Pearl Harbor, why, George was a corporate member at that time, and Clarence Adams, who also come up through the ranks, Dad hired him as a workman in the yard, and he had lots of smarts about lumber. And then he was edgerman, and Clarence Adams then became head sawyer. And then at the death of my father, Clarence Adams took over the presidency and general management at the mill. And of course, times and things change and people grow older. And when I come back to the war as a young man, it was decided that I had better start to come up through the mill. So then that's how come I was purchasing agent and for several years. And also my skill in drafting and mechanical engineering, which I acquired in my education, Oregon State College, all fit well. And I did of the new machinery installation and design and whatever in the
going
middle.
Back for a moment, was there much demand for timber for the war effort during the?
Oh yes, the mill run two shifts, and of course no one thought anything about sustained yield or balanced cut as we do now, because the war effort was on. And in a war effort, you know, it's just like when you're in a desperate fight with a desperate enemy, it's all, everything hangs out and you don't pay any attention to anything. It's a matter of survival, and that's the war effort at that time. I think that describes it pretty well.
That must have brought the whole timber industry out of the depression of the 30s then.
I beg your pardon?
Did this demand for timber during the war bring the whole industry out of its depression?
Oh yes, it did. It was coming out of the depression anyway, because for years there had been no significant housing and no significant construction until around 1938, 37, 38, things slowly began to recover and pick up from the World Depression. And then in 1940, that just added to the steam. But the recovery was already in effect. It was peacetime recovery. And the wartime effort, of course, accelerated everything. And from purchasing agent, I then was a log buyer for Carnation for several years. And we had a scaler at that time, a fellow by the name of Bill Durfeld. He's now head log buyer and timber land and timber procurement for Stimson Lumber Company. And two older members of Carnation Lumber Company, they were getting older and wanted to retire, wanted to quit. And of course I was younger and gung-ho, want to go ahead. Well, anyhow, we found a buyer for their interest, and a person, a logger, by the name of Axel Erickson. So he and I, we still had the corporation, but we were only two corporate members, and law at that time allowed two corporate members. We had one other share out to a Grant Robertson, now dead, and Portland lumberman, outstanding lumberman for years. And we had one share out to him to make the three-member corporation as required by law, corporate law at that time. And that's now changed. And but Axel was a good partner, but he's older than I am, and he was a hard logger. He was a logger of the last generation. And he was a very shrewd businessman, very little education, come from hard beginnings, very difficult beginnings. And his father died at a very early age, and he and his brothers and his mother were left destitute, high, dry, and alone. And in those days, we didn't have the nice, all of these programs that you got now, like welfare and food stamps and God name it. He's a very shrewd businessman, but I learned a lot of things from Axel Ericsson. His main logging all occurred over in the Salmonberry country, north of here, northwest of here. And I learned what to do and some things that I decided were things that you shouldn't do. But that's the way life is, you know. You pay your money and you take your chances, and you always have to stop and evaluate things and say to yourself, is this the right thing for me to do? And but anyhow, Axel and I were partners. Axel handled the logging end, and I handled the sawmill end, and we got along indeed very well together. And after several years, Axel and I decided that Axel had, by this time, had heavy timber interest and logging interest in Northern California. And it was difficult for him to manage that down there and to also take care of this up here. But in addition, he had this difficulty, but in addition to this, it was very tax-wise, it was very advantageous to myself to sell out at that time. And we had a buyer for the mill, but he didn't want the timber and timberland. And with that situation in hand, Axel and I decided we'd let's sell the mill, we'll liquidate the timber, and sever our partnership, which we did. And so the mill and property was sold there to Gales Peak Lumber Company, who had recently had a fire in their own mill, which was located at the junction of the old TV Tualatin Valley Highway and the Carnation Road. And the Carnation Road is now severed because of the bypass cutoff going south of Fourth Crow. And so Fred Boquette and his partners come over and bought the mill and the property. And then Axel and I, we logged together for a short time and then made this separation that I was talking about. And I bought all of the timber and timberland that I could afford to buy, but some of the pieces one piece of timber in particular was very difficult, and I had not too much experience with logging, and this involved high lead, and which I'd had very little experience at. As a matter of fact, I had very little high lead logging system experience, and the last high lead tree that was rigged in this country here, Axel and I rigged it right west of Forest Grove, about 15-17 miles. That's the last high lead tree that was rigged. Now we have all steel spars, high lead systems.
Could you explain high lead a little bit?
Well, high lead is just pretty well describes what it is itself. It's a system whereas you, in those days, you limbed a tree and topped it, and then you hung all your blocks, and you had your yarding donkey down below on the ground. And all your lines you had, I can't remember all the lines now, you start out to rig the tree. After you topped it, you rigged it, you had your rigging block hanging right at the top, and then your main block, and then your receding block, or haulback, what we call haulback block, and then there were other blocks and then you had your main line, receding line, and tail blocks, and top guys, buckle guys, and if you loaded off of the same tree, then you either had what we called a single stick or a hay rack or a loading boom of several varieties, and if they were rigged off of the high lead tree, then you had the loading donkey, if you had a crotch line loading system instead of a hay rack, then you had your diamond lines and your spreaders, And you had your bull block and tail block for that, and good God, there was monkey blocks, and I can't name all the rigging anymore because it's been so long now. I can't begin to name all the parts of rigging because it's been so long now. I have old diagrams around here and so forth like that, but I don't think there's too many loggers left. There's no loggers active left anymore that I think could rig a tree anymore around the country. You know, a logger's life is rather limited in the woods. He starts out as a young man in the woods, and usually his active life in the woods rarely runs longer than 40 or 45 years old. Some fellows stay with it longer, into their 50s and 60s, but not very many of them. Most of them, they start seeking easier jobs at around, say, 45 or something like that. It's getting too hard to jump fast enough to stay out of the way and keep and get your head knocked off. And there are lots of fellows killed in the woods. Actually, there was more accidents in the woods on the old railroad trains than there was actually in the logging itself. And some of those railroad tracks and logging tracks were just not all too safe because they were only temporary at best. And I've ridden those old shays too, the old logging shays. I remember in the 20s it was the custom. It was a custom of the sawmill man. He knew pretty well what his market was going to be for the summer. And he knew what kind of logs he was going to have to supply the demand. And he would go in the spring. It was a custom for him, the sawmill man, to go to the woods and to see what the logger, each of the various local loggers, were going to have in the way of timber, quality and volume. And Dad bought all the logs. He had arrangements made with Sunset Logging Company, which was over in the Cochrane timber area. He had arrangements made that he would buy all of their logs that were 30 inches in diameter and less. That is a smaller, what we used to call a red fir type timber. It was a young old growth, I guess. It was a very good quality timber, and we had lots of it in the country besides the bigger old growth stands. And I always liked to go in the spring with Dad. It usually happened in the month of May, and he would allow me to take a few days off from school to go with him, and we would drive. Dad had a Star 4, and then he had a Star 6 touring, and which I have pictures of here. And we would drive to Gales Creek and to the Timber Junction, and then we would go to timber. And we would park the car there and catch the shay up on into the woods to Sunset, the logging camp. And those were all camp shows in those days, and the fellows only come out of the woods once a week on the weekends. And now it's all home guard shows. That means that you're always home every night, and you can guard the wife and family, and you can take it from there. They're called home guard shows. And I loved to go to those, get on that shay, and would always ride in the cab with the engineer. And boy, that locomotive, that, I'll tell you, those old Climaxes and those shays, they would puff along, and they were all geared down for pulling heavy loads. And they had all those disconnect, what they call disconnect cars behind them, logging trucks or disconnects. And go to the woods, and they would puff along like they were doing 80 miles an hour, and they might be doing 8. They were geared down like that. And Sunset Logging Company always fed good in their camps. And loggers that come in the bunkhouse, I remember, I was only 6, 7, 8, 9 years old. The loggers would pour in there, and they always had one of the bunkhouses was set up as a guest house, and we would sleep in the guest shack. And I can remember in the morning of those fallers and buckers, they'd be out there at 4 and 5 o'clock in the morning, and they'd be walking up and down in front of the bunkhouse, swinging their arms and limbering up their arms for the day, you know. And it was all done with the old sweet fiddles or the hand saws, and no power saws yet, not yet. And cork boots like you never saw. Well, when you make a hard living like that, and it's a hard way, and you're all out there, the fun comes rough, and there are many anecdotes, much humor comes out of the woods that never really reaches town, because no one down here understands the terminology of it to start with. So why talk about it after you get down where the white people are?
Could you tell me some of those anecdotes?
Oh yeah, I can sure tell you a number of anecdotes and things, but I sure do remember that shay. Those were great days in my life when I could take the shay with Dad and go to the woods, and then come back out on the loaded train. And we always had instructions that if the engineer said to jump, why jump? You jump off of this thing, because sometimes those tracks would let loose. Those tracks are not like railroad tracks downtown here in the valley or something like that. They were all cabled and held together on the side of the hill, and they just weren't all too safe. And that's why there was more logging railroad men killed on those old logging railroads than there was ever in the woods. Casualty rate was far higher. But we always had instructions that if the man said jump, the engineer said jump, that meant jump. But those were great days in my life. Some of the logging stories and anecdotes and things like that that I could repeat, and there's many, many of them, hundreds of them, are stem mostly from my logging life, which was a different era than what I'm talking about right now. By the time I and my partner separated, and I bought all the timber and timberland that was remaining between the two of us, bought his half interest out, and some of it sold because of the highly and rough situation of it. Why, and I got started by myself as a sole ownership Brains Logging Company, and the times were right, and I had everything in hock, including the house, everything but the wife and my boy. And I started out, and I knew I had a good thing. And I had some cutting contracts, and I owned a little bit of land. And I started out logging. I had a cutting contract to harvest all of the old growth timber, white fir, cedar, hemlock, in the McMinnville watershed. It's a beautiful place. And it just seemed like good fortune struck me. Every time I turned around, I seemed to find a dollar under a rock someplace. And when I got started, what I did was I paid. I was advised by my partner, Axel Erickson, to pay good logging wages, to pay above the union rate, pay over the union rate, and then go out and shop for your best professional men, your best loggers in the country. And we had them then. So I did. I paid anywhere from 25 to 75 cents an hour over union rate for the different jobs, and I shopped for the best loggers, and I really had a gung-ho young crew, and they were all local men, like in that picture right there. There was all local fellas here, and I started out, and boy, that outfit really did run. We had one of the highest production little companies in the state of Oregon there for several years, and our safety record was good. And whenever, in 5 years of hard logging, high ball logging, I hurt one man, only one man, and he was hurt doing something that I told him not to do just 3 days before. And that's don't ride when those logs were bobtailed or yarded in behind the cat, not to ride the tail end of those logs, and don't walk too close to the ends of them, because a lot of times vine, maple, and other saplings and stuff would drag underneath the logs and then whip back behind them. And he wouldn't pay attention to me, so he got hurt. And that was the only man I hurt in 5 days, or 5 years of hard logging. But that crew, I'm proud of that crew. And we took a week's vacation every spring with pay, and most of the time they elected to work. And whatever they wanted to do was just fine with me. And I never had very little trouble with the crew. They were always good, all good fellows. Most of them were taxpayers, family men that lived here, paid their bills. One of them was Harvey Deathless, for instance, was active 15 years on the Gaston School District down here, school board. And other fellows, After I quit highball logging, my one hooker that I had in at the start of the of my logging days, a successful logger in Northern California, went on from me to there. And the next hooker I had, a fellow by the name of John Campbell, he went to Alaska and started up a reasonably successful little logging outfit up there, pays his bills, I understand, and has done not exceedingly well, but he's done good. And I received Christmas cards and sometimes visits from fellows that have worked for me in the past, and I'm proud of that. That means a lot to me. That's a real value in my life. Because when fellows come to work for me, a set of instructions was that I assumed that when he come to work, he'd already been screened. I'd already screened him, and I knew he knew his job. And I'd tell him that what I expect here, the name of the game is get logs. Now, if you don't think you can stand up and hold up with the rest of the crew, we don't cut the pay here, you'll just have to quit. And it's get logs and get logs safely. And if you can't do that, we don't like to make widows here. We're not widow makers here. But get logs. And get logs they did. One summer we averaged 1,900 board feet per man per day all summer long. And that was well over double the production for the average of the state that year. It was about 936 board feet per man per day. That was high lead systems and bobtail systems or cataloging for the state that year. And but we had a show, I want to tell you, you just wouldn't believe it. And talk about loggers and cork boots. And from that time backwards through the 30s and the 20s, we had, this country here was not quite so civilized as it is now. And Saturday night dances, and the fellas would all get in from the woods. The Saturday night dances at Shadyside Dance Hall and out to Bomb Grove. The wild affairs, if those went on today, with the state police and the National Guard and every other thing, would be out here in the FBI to round up the moonshiners and separate to quell the riot. You wouldn't believe it. And we always used to speculate. I remember when I was a teenager, we always used to, several of us, get together and speculate, you know, where are we going tonight? I wonder where we're going to have the biggest Donnybrook tonight, whether it's going to be Balm Grove or it's going to be Shadyside. And I remember Shadyside, loggers a lot of times, Saturdays, they'd be in from the woods. Maybe they didn't even have their cork boots changed yet, but they always had to stop and whet their whistle at the tavern. And sometimes they didn't, maybe they'd show up with their logging clothes on, and maybe they're just their slippers. We call them dancing slippers. And if they didn't have their dancing slippers, sometimes they were there in their corks. And for the Saturday night dance, and when the fight started, he'd always run over to the side and stand up on the benches so as you could get a better view. And I could tell you about some of those fights. Sometimes it got into six or seven of them going all at the same time. I remember one time in Shadyside Dance Hall, they had one door with the Shadyside was built right on the edge of Gale's Creek, or Scalgan's Creek. Right on the edge of Scalgan's Creek, right exactly where the old TV highway goes over the Scalgan's Creek right there. It's now, it fell down with the snow here maybe 10, 12 years ago, something like that. But anyhow, this door on the side of the building was always nailed shut, but loggers all got in a fight there one night, and they picked up one guy and threw him right through the door, and he went out right over the bank and right in the creek. And there's some other stories. I can tell you a story. Good God, even the girls used to get into it one time, one night. One night we were out there at Balm Grove, and two girls got into some kind of a scrap. I don't know what it was over. Anyhow, the fight was on, and outside they went, and right in front of the doorsteps of Balm Grove Dance Hall out there was a heck of a big mud puddle. It was right in the middle of winter, and the darn mud puddle, I don't know, seemed to me like it was maybe 10, 12 feet across and maybe 4 or 6 inches deep, something like that. And those girls got to scrapping it out right in the middle of that mud puddle. And by God, we have stood up on cars and everything else to watch the fight. And one of them got down, got the other one down in the middle of that mud puddle. If that wasn't a dress square up over her head, and God Almighty, no pants on, and turn that thing off for a minute, and I'll tell you the rest of it. See if you want to record it. One of these girls, I don't remember who the girls were, but I got the other one down in the middle of this mud puddle, and I got her dresses up over her head, no pants on, and five guys, she just reached right down and grabbed a hold of her hair right between the crotch and just stretched that